2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Chip Hazenflow. Welcome, graduates.
We're just a couple of guys sitting around talking about things that are important to us. Hopefully they're important to you. And if you need more information, there's so many great ways to find more information. Yes, Chip, this week is graduation week. Your oldest daughter and my oldest son are both graduating from high school. What a time to be alive.
Who would have thought, you know, we just had these kids, right?
Yeah.
They were just little kids.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And now they get thrown out in the world, Steve.
Yeah.
They get kicked out of the nest to go off to do what they need to do.
And hopefully we've given them all the tools that they need to get everything done that they need.
So as we should start off with our speech by talking about all they've accomplished and then, you know, looking forward to the future. And, you know, how lucky they are to have the coronavirus right here to keep them home.
Good timing.
To keep them thinking about maybe, you know, make a little more anxiety, right? They came to the world in 9/11.
Right.
Yeah. And they're sent out in the world during the coronavirus. This is certainly a unique generation, isn't it?
Just this one year, not the whole generation. My eighth grader, who's finishing eighth grade and going to high school, is certainly of a different ilk than my son, who's leaving high school and going on to his adult life. This group of kids has faced adversity and come up against it and really made something of themselves. I'm so proud of all of these students in this age category, but my son especially.
Let me just point that out again. Born 9/11, the year of 9/11, somewhere right around that time.
Yep.
Okay. So they had the Great Recession.
Mm-hmm.
This is in their youth. And, you know, a lot of families went through a lot of adversity during that time.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, they graduate with the coronavirus. This certainly, this could be an incredibly resilient group. They certainly have experienced a lot of life as young people.
And they don't take a lot for granted. They don't take for granted what life is and how normal acts, because normal has changed for them at least twice, if not three times in their lives.
Oh, what a unique group. I'm so proud of them. I'm, you know, 2020, if I was writing a book, I think the year 2020 would always be a good year to throw in there for the high school proms or anything like that as kind of a wink that those things didn't get to take place.
That's right. The NBA championship in 2020, nobody.
Well, that's not finished yet. They're still looking at it. There are states open right now, and they're practicing.
Okay.
So this will finish out.
We'll see. I have no idea what's going to happen, Chip. The future is a blur to me. I don't know what's going to happen.
All right.
Time travel.
Film at 11.
Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. I got a chance to see the new Amazon Prime series, Upload. This is from the mind of Greg Daniels, the guy who brought us The Office, the American version, and Parks and Recreation. This is the story of the singularity. We talked about it last week, where the singularity is near. In probably the next 25 years or so, you might have the opportunity to upload your consciousness into a computer and to live, quote unquote, as a being inside of a computer. That's exactly the story of Upload here. A young man is killed in a self-driving car accident, which is ridiculous in and of itself. And all of the characters say, no, self-driving cars don't crash. And he goes, well, mine did. He dies and his consciousness is uploaded to basically heaven. Anything that you want, anytime, it's there for you. But the dark twist of this is his girlfriend is the one whose account he was uploaded to, and she has control of every aspect of his life in this computer simulation.
Oh my goodness. Well, that certainly sets up for an interesting twist on it. This is 10 episodes. How many episodes did you get in?
These are 30-minute episodes, so this is a total of 5 hours of viewing. We got it done in about 16 hours of viewing.
Oh, you saw them all.
We saw them all, right, one after the other. This story just keeps going. It is that sort of story that is built for binge watching. It is excellent storytelling. The characters are so well developed. You know everything about these characters very quickly, and this has every aspect of storytelling that you can think of. There's drama. There is so much comedy. There are so many silly things that happen in this. There is intrigue because there is certainly a mystery that needs to be solved. And there's so many great relationships between the characters. I really highly recommend that you go to your Amazon Prime and watch this series.
All right. So if you have Amazon Prime, you can watch this. And it looks like it was pretty successful. They already set up for season two, right?
That's right. Greg Daniels wrote this as a two-season arc. So when season one was picked up by Amazon Prime, he was really hopeful that season two would be greenlit. And it was on Saturday. We are going to get season two of Upload.
That's interesting. So a five-hour movie, 10, 30-minute episodes. And then they'll have whatever the second season. That certainly is a new way of thinking of, you know, it's longer than a movie, but, you know, not too long.
We've seen such great things being done with that flexibility online, where we see an 8-hour story and it's so much better than a 2-hour version of that same story. I think, of course, of the Stephen King stories. Stephen King writes these giant books, and if you try to make that into a 2-hour movie, it might not be all that entertaining. But if you can make it into a 5-hour or 8-hour exploration of those characters, you might have something special. And I think Upload is an example of one of those special things.
All right, so Amazon gave you another series this week, right?
Well, to be fair, our friend Bears Rebecca Fonte gave me a gift this week. This is the movie James versus His Future Self. And our friend Bears runs the Otherworlds Austin Film Festival. Mm-hmm. But since the coronavirus, that film festival is not happening this year. So what Bears has done is given us some of these movies that normally would be a part of the film festival online. And I had the opportunity to have a conversation with the filmmakers for this movie, Jonas Cernick and Jeremy Lalonde. Those two guys made this movie and had a very interesting conversation about it afterwards. This is the story of a scientist who meets a version of himself from the future. The future version has traveled back in time to stop himself from inventing time travel. The older version of this character is played by Daniel Stern, and he really shines in this character.
This sounds interesting.
It's wonderful. This is another one that I really suggest people go out and find. It is an independent film, but it doesn't suffer from some of those problems that some independent films have. It has great storytelling. It has great character development. And there's a whole aside in the middle of the movie about mindfulness and being in the present. I asked them about that in the interview, and I said, whose idea was this idea of being focused on the present? And they replied, it was both of their ideas. The idea of focusing on the present in a time travel story was something that they never saw before, and I haven't either. It works really well.
I was going to say, certainly something that's very timely for right now, as we feel like, you know, time has stopped for many people out there.
Don't worry about the past. Don't worry about the future. Focus on the present. That's the mindfulness that we've talked about so many times on the show.
And Netflix has given us a documentary on something about what to do with the future.
Yeah, again, focusing on the present is important, but having an eye toward the future is a part of this conversation too. We have the documentary Becoming. This is the story of former First Lady Michelle Obama touring with her book called Becoming. In that book, she was exploring who she was after her time in the White House. What was she going to do? What was she going to achieve now that she has left that position? And she brings in her tour a group of young people who are at the same threshold. What does the future look like for a college graduate, for a high school graduate? And what can we do with our time?
Mm-hmm. And you may not have all the answers, but you certainly can explore something you may want to do.
And there's so many things that are explored in this. The power of gathering is one thing that's explored. Getting together as a group to have conversations, to start thinking about what you're going to do. Sharing a set of experiences is something that we talk about a lot. And I look forward to getting back to the convention scene when I'm able to talk to strangers and explore their experiences. That's something that's focused on here.
Well, Disney Plus obviously gave us, you know, the code of the Mandalorian, Steve.
This is the way. This is the way the Mandalorian was made. This is Disney Gallery, Star Wars, The Mandalorian. This is an 8-episode series, a behind-the-scenes look at the making of The Mandalorian. The show that saved Star Wars is really should be the subtitle.
That's right. And Jon Favreau is so money, Steve. He's one of the directors.
He is the creator of this series, really. He is the central person who made this, along with Dave Filoni. Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau worked so well together on this. And having them sit down and have a conversation, the first episode is all about the directors of the episodes of The Mandalorian. And we get all of the personalities of those five people who brought us these beautiful visions and saved Star Wars.
Well, other than Baby Yoda, what have you pulled out of the making of this show?
The passion for the material is on display here. How much they wanted Star Wars to live on afterwards. The passion, the going out into the desert and filming these things, it's hard. It's very difficult. And trying to make it happen for the audience is on display. Taika Waititi is just the superstar director now. And he talks a little bit about how he was a struggling independent filmmaker and he found his voice through that struggle. and made this happen. Bryce Dallas Howard, you know what, Chip? I have to admit, I did not know until this documentary that Bryce Dallas Howard was the daughter of Ron Howard. And it makes sense now that I look at her and look at him and I go, they are related. She has a great story about coming to Star Wars and being a part of this and being a powerful director like her father and finding her voice. This is a great series. I only watched the first episode. That's only the first episode, the directors. There are at least 2 episodes out now. You should go to Disney Plus and check out those.
All right, Steve. Obviously, you went to a galaxy far, far away, but that's not the only science fiction galaxy you went to.
Right. I went to the moon, Alice. Mystery Science Theater did something that they've never done in the 30-year history of Mystery Science Theater. They riffed an episode of Mystery Science Theater this week. For the first time in 30 years, they got together a crew, a host, a Tom Servo, and a Crow-T robot, and made fun of their own work from 1990. They riffed the movie Moon 02, and it was so much fun.
Riffed the movie, and they also riffed themselves.
They riffed the episode where they were riffing the movie, yes.
Okay. Making fun of themselves. Nothing like the young whippersnappers going after the old ones.
Right. There was a degree of that. But this was all about community. This was all about coming together. We've seen so many of these things happening in this it's a very unusual time that we're in. All of these people looking back at their work and sharing it in a community setting. That's what we got with this. We, the community, were watching while they were watching a movie that they were watching. It was very meta.
Steve, we got to share a moment where a comedian jumped out of a helicopter, didn't we?
Yes. Netflix this week brought us Jerry Seinfeld's latest special, 23 Hours to Kill. We have talked about Jerry Seinfeld so many times. He is one of those beacons of comedy. So he performed at the Beacon Theater. Get it?
They have a place to go. You gotta get there, Steve. And then you gotta go home.
Yeah, this... I tell you, I like Jerry Seinfeld's storytelling. He is one of the better storytellers that we have, but this really fell flat for me in a lot of ways.
Well, I will agree with that. You know, one of the reasons to go see Jerry Seinfeld is you're familiar with his old material, mm-hmm. and you like Jerry Seinfeld. He's a comedian that connects with his audience really, really well. But I think I'm going to agree with you. He is working with new material he put together. And it is not as crisp, maybe a good way of saying it. You're still enjoying it because you know, you like Jerry Seinfeld.
I agree with that. I like talking with Jerry Seinfeld. Seeing Jerry Seinfeld talk at me is something that is enjoyable. This is just not laugh out loud, funny storytelling. And it's not exactly old man get off my lawn storytelling either. He is somewhere in between those two things. And it's that in between, that mushy middle that I really, I enjoyed this. It was fine. Sure. I'm glad that I watched it, but I wouldn't exactly suggest it.
Well, and it shows you the challenge it is to work at such a high level. Yeah, this certainly is an A-plus work. The Jerry at his peak, but you know, this is serviceable Jerry. Yeah, he's got his place there.
I'm sure he would love the idea of serviceable Jerry.
Well, you know, the deal is he's not Michael Jordan Bulls championship level. Right. He's Michael Jordan that you saw he played for the Washington Wizards.
Okay, there you go. This is the Washington Wizards season of Jerry Seinfeld. I totally buy that. You got a chance to see some interesting titles. You saw the new version of Valley Girl. This is the musical version, the musical adaptation of the 1983 film, right?
It is. And it does star Alicia Silverstone as the mom, and she's telling the story. And the daughter, of course, is rolling her eyes because mom's going to tell a story about when, you know, she used to do things during her time. This is not a great musical.
Okay.
But this is a very fun musical. And I think this is where we want to kind of put it. Orion is the movie company that's releasing this. They came out with Anna and the Apocalypse, you know, a couple Christmases ago. Where, if you remember that, that was Anna running through a zombie Christmas movie.
Musical. Zombie Christmas musical, yes. This movie has everything.
And certainly not the lowest of low budgets, but not, you know, on the, you know, this is not Cats type budget, if we wanted to put it on level.
Boy. That's your bar now is Cats?
Well, Valley Girl doesn't have a Cats-like budget. But it has all those great songs from the 1980s that you know. I think they did a really good job with the Cars, You Might Think. They made it kind of a punk song, and he's singing it. And if you've seen a few of the Disney shows, you certainly are going to recognize some faces in this. They've got a nice cast. They did a pretty good job with the dancing and stuff like that. The costuming stuff is not perfectly from the 80s, but certainly when you watch it, you go, oh, yes, this is a group of people today looking back on basically your youth. Mm-hmm. I thought this was a lot of fun. I think a lot of families will enjoy it. There's nothing in it, I think, that's too outlandish. So I think it would be okay with families.
Okay. Then you went down a little bit of a Stanley Kubrick rabbit hole this week, right?
Yeah, I got to see two Kubrick films. One was Barry Lyndon, which many people have said is the most beautiful film, or one of the most beautiful films ever recorded. That certainly, and then the other one was Lolita. So Barry Lyndon was from 1975, Lolita is from 1962. I'm going to discuss them sort of together. This is part of my exploration of Kubrick. Kubrick is a director that we all should study. 2001, Clockwork Orange, you know,
Shining.
Oh my goodness. And you know, Eyes Wide Shut was his last film. But my point is that there's something always to notice about these films. Barry Lyndon was about an Irishman who basically had to leave home quickly. He was a young guy. He joined the army after he was robbed. He ended up having affairs and abandoned his military career, only to be put into another military army. And then eventually marries, gains a title, only to be bought out at the end. I think what we want to know about this story is there certainly is a huge evolution in our character development during this time. This is not a good guy. But what you're basically doing is experiencing his life. Lolita is incredibly uncomfortable. This is about pedophilia, of all the things. In fact, I had to stop the film and read a little bit about what the story was about to go forward on this, because I was going like, how in the world did they ever make this film? Because
a question that I've seen on the internet is it is pretty shocking, this material, and it is pretty shocking that it's been made and distributed as a film twice.
Yeah, and this is from 1962, and this was, you know, Kubrick only has so many films. This is the one he said, oh, I've got to film this. So this is about a middle-aged college professor coming in to a boarding house with a widow and her daughter, choosing that place because he saw the daughter, who is 14 years old. The mom ultimately dies. He takes her away, and basically just his infatuation with her drives this relationship, which when you start thinking about it, you go, where did this come from? Mm-hmm. Now, the book has a number of quirks to it. One, you don't know if this professor is a reliable narrator, which I don't really see this in this film. But like I said, I was kind of shocked to watch this. As with most Kubrick films, you're very happy that you went through them. They usually have huge arcs over a period of time. There's a twist at Lolita's ending that I won't give away, but the whole time you're questioning, like, holy cow, am I really watching this? I'm glad I watched it because Kubrick is a great director. I'm not sure if this story was something I want to revisit or even read a lot about. Let's just say I finished part of my study of Kubrick.
There you go. That's about as good as you can say on Lolita. Yes, it is uncomfortable. And the question of, should we make uncomfortable stories so that we can point out that this is not culturally okay? That's a whole nother conversation that we'll have to have another day. But yeah, this is uncomfortable at best. Stacy got a chance to see another horror movie this week. Let's see what she saw.
Hi everyone, I'm back with more horror movies to help you decide what you can watch whilst the cinemas are closed. So, first up, anthology films. If you're having trouble focusing at the moment, and let's face it, aren't we all, then perhaps an anthology film is the way to go. If that's the case, I highly recommend Nightmare Cinema from 2019, which you can find exclusively on Shudder. Set in an old cinema, the film introduces five different short stories starring people who've been lured in to show them their deepest, darkest fears by the projectionist, played ably by Mickey Rourke, who preys on their souls. Each directed short is by a great within the horror genre, and there's a little something for everyone here, ranging from the slasher movie to religious horror to all-out psychological weirdness. My personal favourite is the second story, which is directed by Joe Dante, who makes a fun, weird and creepy look at relationships and plastic surgery turn darker than you would expect, whilst also showing you what a toxic relationship can look like at its very worst, amped up. Aside from the greats that are directing the stories themselves, there are flashes of other greats from horror within the stories, including John Carpenter, David Lynch, and David Cronenberg, to name a few. And if you're concerned that this being an anthology means that the films will be hit or miss within it, as is often sadly the way, it's not so with Nightmare Cinema, where they manage to maintain their consistency without making any of the films samey. This is a very watchable, well-made and enjoyable anthology, which slightly surprised me as they are by no means my favourite type of horror. You can watch it in one go or pause between stories and you won't lose anything from it either way. I wish more anthology horrors were like Nightmare Cinema, because if they were, I'd watch a lot more of them gladly. Now, on that note, Dead Time Stories, which is currently available on Amazon Prime and came out in 1986, showcases why I'm not the anthology film's biggest fan. Anthology horrors are tricky to do well, because you need consistent short stories within it, which is hard to do as they're often done separately by completely different teams of creatives. They have to be different enough to warrant being separate stories, whilst they still have to have a cohesiveness to necessitate them being within the same film, And there also needs to be a wraparound story to tie them all together that works. There's so much more additional thought and work that has to go into making one of these anthology films. And more often than not, the ones I've seen just don't quite manage to do it. So, in Dead Time Stories, the wraparound story is a child who won't go to bed, and an uncle desperate for him to do so, who tells him stories to placate him. Through this, the audience is treated to a handful of scary stories. And I'm using both the words treated and scary very loosely here, believe me. From a somewhat dull medieval tale of witchcraft, to a risque rip-off of Little Red Riding Hood that feels like Porky's, to a Goldilocks rip-off that has a very fleeting hint of Carrie that just doesn't stick around, the whole thing really doesn't work. There's a lot of cringing, pained sighs, and questions left unanswered whilst you're watching this film, but very little enjoyment. I kind of found this a struggle to keep my focus on, to be honest, and I love 80s films. There is no cohesiveness or consistency between the tales, other than this vague idea that they're maybe all fairy tales. And you do find yourself questioning why on earth someone will be telling these stories, especially the risque one, to their very young nephew to try and get them to go to sleep. This feels less like a horror film and more like a cry for parenting classes, which is a shame. It has a decent budget behind it, and it's clear a lot of work went into finding a really strong cast and good-looking sets. But what we get here is somewhat dreary, and far too often a very cringeworthy repurposing of fairy tales that fails to spark any joy. Dead Time Stories is fine, I guess, if you want something on in the background that doesn't require attention, but I expected far more from it. If you want to watch a good horror anthology, there are other options, including the previously discussed Nightmare Cinema, Del Toro's wonderful Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, if you want something more family-friendly, but also beautiful and spooky, or for those wanting something a little lesser known, there is Tale of Tales, which I reviewed on my website some time ago that you can have read of, which uses Italian fairy tales and gives them a dark arthouse fantasy film take featuring an all-star cast that was a hit at Cannes and with me. And that is about all for this time. If you want to hear more of my ramblings on films and whatnot, or chat with me about horror, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Films with Stacey, where you can also find links to my website to read more, including that review of Tale of Tales that I mentioned. Until next time, happy viewing.
Thank you, Stacey. I appreciate all of your hard work. I hope you're having a great time across the pond. Just as much fun being in your house as we are in our house. Opening, or more likely streaming this week, the first movie on our list is Scoob! Exclamation point.
This is an animated film, computer animated film, that is being, they chose to release it. And they're not releasing it in theaters, as I originally intended. This is going to be a video on demand. Trolls 2 was a $100 million release. So I think what's happening is these types of family films, and having a character like Scooby-Doo, is certainly is something that they're going to try it again.
I look forward to this. When they released this trailer, BC, before Corona, I was excited about this movie coming out. And now that it's going to be released video on demand, you can bet your money that I will watch this movie as soon as I can. It's an all-star cast. Frank Welker is coming back as the voice of Scooby-Doo for the first time in a very long time. We've got Will Forte as Shaggy, Mark Wahlberg as the Blue Falcon, Jason Isaacs is in there, Zac Efron as Freddy, and a couple of, maybe I shouldn't mention, because there's some special guest stars in this episode of Scooby-Doo that I really look forward to seeing.
Steve, are there any movies that Liam Neeson should have been starring in?
Maybe Liam Neeson's phone didn't ring one day, and so Tom Berenger got instead. Yeah, there's a movie called Blood and Money that features Tom Berenger as a retired veteran hunting in northern Maine when he stumbles across a huge bag of money, and fire and bullets ensue.
Well, it looks like that Tom Berenger has a certain set of skills.
Yes. Just walking around with big lips. That's Tom Berenger. I don't remember the last Tom Berenger movie that I've seen. The first one that comes to mind is Major League.
Wrestler's Rhapsody, Steve.
I don't, what? Which one?
Wrestler's Rhapsody. He was a cowboy, Steve.
Oh.
He wore a white hat.
Well, then maybe.
He was a singing cowboy.
Okay.
And his partner ate a lot of roots.
Okay. So maybe he's got an action adventure bent to him for this one.
Steve, are there any science fiction films?
Yeah, there's a very interesting movie called The Vast of Night that's coming out this week. This is about a switchboard operator and a radio DJ in the 1950s in New Mexico that they receive a sound over their airwaves, one through the phone and one through the radio, and a mystery of where this particular sound comes from leads them to looking to the skies, and maybe the 1950s was visited by alien life forms in New Mexico. That sounds familiar.
Sounds Twilight Zone-ish, Steve.
It does. I look forward to that one. I spent a lot of time really investigating alien life in New Mexico.
So Steve and I groaned when we saw initially that this film was being released, but Netflix has a true gift for us this week.
I think so. Based on the trailer, I think we really encourage everyone to at least click on this trailer. The movie is called The Wrong Missy, and the trailer opens with a picture of old man David Spade, and we went, David Spade. But then suddenly, when the story kicks in, we realize that this is not really about David Spade. This is about a young lady named Lauren Lapkus, who is...
Well, she plays Chris Farley, Steve.
She's playing the Chris Farley character in this movie. And it is the most slapstick, silly concept. And I look forward to this movie, believe it or not.
So this is all comedy and all juvenile fun comedy.
Yes.
I hope this movie is as good as this trailer. Because Steve and I were laughing so hard.
We were laughing out loud at this trailer. I really encourage you to at least click on the trailer in our show notes and give The Wrong Missy a chance.
Book it.
Chip, you know, we have talked to lots of great people, and with the pandemic going on, we have had the ability to contact even more people because they can't say no. They got nothing better to do. They're sitting in front of their computers with microphones.
I think that's what they call social distancing, Steve.
Yes, social distancing has been a boon to the podcast industry. And you know what? I've been reading a lot more in the pandemic and the social distancing era. How about you?
Well, one day the pandemic's going to end, Steve. Do we have anyone that can help us figure out what it's going to be like?
Yeah, that brings me to a book that I finally got to. It was in my stack of books that I wanted to read, and finally there was time enough at last for me to read A Beginning at the End. Mike Chen is the author, and he's joining us to talk all about it. How's it going, Mike?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for having the time to talk to us about your amazing writing. This book came out in January, A Beginning at the End. It's just your second book, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my debut came out in January 2019, and that was called Here and Now and Then, and that was a time travel book. And then I thought I would try to shift subgenres in sci-fi with each of my books. So I went to post-pandemic with my second one, and look where we are now.
Well, in fact, the book seems so timely. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, so it takes place 6 years after a pandemic, one with that's a little bit more brutal than what we're getting with COVID-19. About 70% of the population has been wiped out. And in this world, population has resurfaced from an international government quarantine. And so you have people living in like metropolitan areas and then some like communes. And then in between, there's like these wasteland gangs. And most of the book takes place in a restored San Francisco as you have a single dad and his young daughter. You have an event planner and you have a woman who used to be the biggest pop star on the planet, but she's now in hiding. And their paths cross as there's a shadow of rumors of a new pandemic coming. And saying anything more would kind of spoil things.
All post-pandemic, this is after where we're at now with quarantining, And why did you choose that as your setting?
So this book was originally drafted in 2011-ish. And the idea, back then when I was writing, I really love writing family drama type stories, but I was trying to find like a place for them, like a context for them, because I wasn't happy just writing contemporary stories. And it showed in my writing because I wasn't getting anywhere. And so one of my big inspirations is Nick Hornby. I love his writing style. I love his characterizations. And I just thought of talking with my critique partner about what if I took like About a Boy and like put it in the apocalypse or something like that. And I thought it was a ridiculous idea. And she's like, no, you should do it. Just try it and see what happens. The original manuscript got shelved for a few years and then things went on to Here and Now and Then. But then my agent had pulled it off the shelf and he said, I really like a lot of this, but we have to like basically destroy it and rebuild it back up. So there's an apt metaphor in there for our world. But the idea was, I really wanted to focus on, in a lot of apocalyptic fiction, it's usually either like the immediate outbreak where everyone's like panicking and like trying to kill each other for food and things like that. Or it's like, you know, some undetermined time in the future where society has already reshifted and recalibrated, like, you know, the Hunger Games type of thing. Mm-hmm. And I thought what would be really interesting, and I thought of this like watching Walking Dead around that time, like basically thinking like, you know, when Carl was still young on Walking Dead, what if things had recovered and then he would be like this, you know, 12, 13-year-old kid with all this death around him. And that was kind of one of the ideas and themes that inspired this, is like, no one really talks about like, if you recover from something like this, there's going to be a whole lot of trauma involved. And the book was originally written as a metaphor for trauma. I didn't expect it to actually happen. So here we are.
Much more about characters, this book, and I'm glad to hear that you said this is the style of writing that you like, but you needed to find the frame of the sci-fi. This is much more character-driven than sci-fi, right?
I'd say sci-fi is definitely shifting. I think people still tend to lump, when they hear sci-fi and fantasy, they tend to either lump it into Star Wars, Star Trek, or Game of Thrones. Like, it's very easy to slot things into that. You have like space opera fantasy like Star Wars, you have hard sci-fi like Star Trek, and then you have, you know, epic fantasy like Game of Thrones or Lord of the Rings. You know, like there's like shifts in between that. But in the book community, there's actually a lot more, I'd say in the past 5 years or so, there's been a big shift towards accepting like just weirder stuff or more character-driven stuff. I would say I'm lucky that I kind of caught this wave of acceptance for this type of subgenre. Like, there's a group of us where, like, you know, we were all kind of came out between like the past few years, and now we're like being asked to blurb like the next wave of these types of books coming out. So there's definitely some commercial traction with that there.
So you, I think you're saying you build a world and that the reader is willing to accept whatever the parameters of that world are.
Yeah, exactly. And so what I tend to come up with first is a very rough, like, I want this to be, you know, a post-apocalyptic, or I want this to be a time travel. And then I kind of build out like the character plot from there. And then once I know that the characters are working and like the emotional core of the story is there, then I start filling in the world stuff. Because I find world building to be really, really difficult. So it involves a lot of lists at the end where I'm just like checking off, like, did I answer this question? Or like, where can I slot this in? Usually one of my later revision passes towards the end of like the writing cycle is just strictly to make sure the world building is there. So I have some friends who, like, they have like these reams of, you know, notebooks, like they're making an RPG campaign, and like, I just can't do that. I'm just not good enough to do that.
Well, let me ask you a question about, with the pandemic currently going on, mm-hmm. do you think your character's responses with this post-apocalyptic world would have changed if you wrote it today versus when you wrote it, I guess, when you originally started writing it and you rewrote it?
I think the big difference. I have seen a lot of really eerie similarities where, like, you know, watching the news or just observing things, and it's like, whoa, that's exactly like what I wrote. And that's kind of unnerving. But there's the huge difference where, like, my mortality rate was like exponentially higher than what it is now. You know, knock on wood. and I think that really fuels the character response. The closest one to like being grounded in, I think, our reality is Rob, who his wife died in quarantine, and he had to like basically handle how am I going to raise this child in this new world. I think we're going to have some level of that. Like, I've known probably 10 or 15 people that have actually like gotten COVID, and you know, they're all like, you know, within I guess 25 to 50 or so, and it sucked and it was terrible and they recovered. But I personally knew like one person where his father died, and he's kind of just like, we're all angry for him, you know, because sure. It's like, you know, with the way that regulations were and with the way things were rolled out, it's like this, it feels like it really didn't have to happen. And I think that's like a lot of the internal anger that Rob feels with his wife dying in quarantine in the book, is like struggling with like, did this really have to happen this way, and how do I deal with it? So that's probably the thing that's going to touch closest to home.
And your first book, Here and Now and Then, was more time travel than connections between people, but there's a lot of great connections that you wrote in that book as well. Characters really drive your storytelling, I think.
Yeah, I think what I really attach to. I think both in what I read and then also what I write. Actually, it's funny because this has changed how I play video games. Because, you know, when I grew up in the 80s and 90s, it was just about like, you know, get through the level and, you know, it's fun to play. And now I find that I can't play, like, my wife is totally loves Animal Crossing, and I'm like, I'm bored because there's no story, there's no character to attach to. I can't play one of those, you know, endless like dungeon games or like a puzzle game that never ends. Like, I need to feel invested in the character and then go on this like interactive journey with them. So I think like character is just really, really important to me. When I find myself attached to like a franchise or a show or you know, a video game or something like that, it's always the character that brings me into it. So I think that's winds up being where my focus is as a writer. With this book in particular, like one of the really freaky occurrences with like real world, like today, there's a scene in the school, like the elementary school, and one of the characters notes about how there's like these like anthropomorphic cartoon animals like teaching kids how to put on masks. And it's like, you know, I thought that was be a neat detail because, you know, I remember elementary school, you go in and like, you know, they teach you to eat your lunch properly or whatever, you know, like they have like little cartoon, like Baybar the elephant teaching you to read a book or whatever. And I thought, well, that would be a neat shift to show how this world has changed, that like, it's all about like, you know, safety and like sanitation and things like that. And then, you know, right before my daughter's preschool shut down, like they had things like that where like, you know, little cartoons about like washing your hands and like putting on a mask and things. So I try to just put myself into the situation or a scene and then like try to look around and think realistically, what would you notice people are doing, or like what would be on the walls, or what would people be saying to enhance the world outside of the characters.
So this book is not exactly a manual for these times, but what do you want your readers to know about their lives after pandemic, 6 years after the pandemic?
I think, so the book, like I said before, the book was written originally as a metaphor for trauma. And the original title of it, the working title, was called The Pause, because the idea was like, what if the world doesn't actually end, it just kind of pauses and resets. And when people undergo trauma, that's what they tend to do, is like they pause and they have trouble resetting to like, you know, recalibrate whatever their new life is. So that was the going thought into this. And the way you get out of that is just by letting the right people in and keeping the right people out. And I think getting through this for us as a family, like, it's kind of, we've kind of seen like who we can rely on and like who we need to really connect with and who makes us feel good and comfortable about our lives, even though like we can't physically be with them. I think, you know, understanding that coming out of this and like just understanding who is important and what you need to do to keep in contact with them. And like, that's going to get you through a situation like this, because it's really easy for us as people, like when we undergo trauma, you kind of wind up getting stuck in like the same patterns. And the whole book is really talking about like, how do you break out of those patterns to find the people that will really help you rather than hurt you. And I think like we're all going to be thinking about that a lot in the next year.
What? How fascinating. And in fact, you know, finding that new normal and then, you know, finding the group you want to share that journey with. Wow. That's fascinating. Yeah,
that phrase, the new normal, is in your writing here.
And yeah.
Idea of what are we going to look like when we are done with this pause? Well, this is definitely a pause in everything that we're doing. And boy, that's a great metaphor that you're using there.
And it's weird. I mean, like part of like the freaky, you know, seeing things come out in real time. Like there was something that I saw. I was like, you know, either on like MSNBC or whatever, where they're talking about how like, you know, the world has now paused. And I'm kind of like, hey, I wrote that like, you know, 7 or 8 years ago. Yeah. So like just really, it is really weird to have this come out now and be shared with the world now as it's happening and have readers tell me like, yeah, well, how about that? I'm like, yeah, I know. It's really weird. It's surreal and kind of disturbing, but also really cool. It's very strange.
So our Nostradamus.
Yeah.
These are Nostradamus. Tell us about the future.
Well, I made a joke about this on Twitter the other day, because the proposal that I'm working on for my fourth book is, involves alien abduction. And then of course the government put out the videos of the UFOs like 2 weeks ago, and I'm like, so I posted that, and like all the responses are like, can you write about like a utopia where everyone has health care and they're just happy? I'm like, okay, I have to do this. I have to write a very gentle book with no conflict in it at all.
It's the happiness. The happiness. Everyone's happy.
So you said your fourth book, so that means that you have a third book that's planned for us already. Tell us about what we can look forward to in the future, Nostradamus.
So the superheroes, starting around January next year. So the third book is called We Could Be Heroes. Right now, we're just in final like polish edits, and we should be getting like advanced review copies over the summer and like doing the cover reveal and all that stuff. And that's about a superhero and a supervillain who unknowingly become friends in an anonymous support group. And then when they discover their true identities, they decide to put aside their differences and figure out how they came to be. And so that comes out in January of next year, assuming publishing doesn't shift any schedules due to this pandemic.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
That sounds like right up our alley. We talk about superheroes on this show all the time, not just Doctor Who.
So I tend to be inspired by like the media that I'm watching at the time. Like I said, that, you know, with the beginning at the end, originally written around the time that I watched a lot of The Walking Dead. This upcoming one like really spawned from like just binging all of the Marvel Netflix shows at once. So it's like really highly inspired by, in particular, Daredevil and Jessica Jones.
Where listeners find more about your writing and all of these future projects that we are really going to have you back to talk about?
Yeah. Hopefully we can talk at a con next year. I'm most active on Twitter, and so it's Mike Chen Writer, and the joke that I always make is that there are several very active Mike Chens on Twitter. One of them is a YouTube food guy who has like millions of followers, and I sometimes get his fan mail. And there's a tech entrepreneur guy, so you have to do Mike Chen Writer at there. Otherwise, you're going to get one of those other guys. And then my website, which I don't update enough, but has like all of the official releases and links and stuff. That's MikeChenBooks.com.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called A Beginning at the End, author Mike Chen. You can find all of the information in our show notes.
Scroll with it.
Brings us to our scroll with it. You know, it is May. Are we halfway through May? Almost halfway through May. It is time to talk about the Geek Pride Day gathering, which will not be a gathering. We're going to do it online this year.
Gathering alone.
That's what geeks do. The 25th of May is Geek Pride Day 2020. You can go to our website, geekprideday.net, and find all the information there. And let's get together. Let's talk about some things.
It's Towel Day. What else are you going to do, Steve?
It's Towel Day. It is the anniversary of Star Wars.
I've never heard of it.
It's this little sci-fi movie. Don't worry about it. It was saved by The Mandalorian, though. So I look forward to our conversations for Geek Pride Day coming up. Our conversations about Sherlock Holmes, though, boy, oh boy, Chip, are we having, we're having too much fun, really.
What, too much scrolling? It's too much fun?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Well, I will thank Professor Pamela Bedour for recommending that we continue to read all of these Sherlock Holmes short stories during the coronavirus. And we're almost finished with this next volume.
Uh-huh.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing that we have continued this as long as we have. Episode 49 of the Pam Bedour and the other two guys show is dropping tomorrow. Tune in every morning and listen to our silly. We've gotten more and more silly as we've gone on, Chip. The stories have matured more than we have, sir. But yes, we are reading through The Return of Sherlock Holmes, which was published in 1904, every morning. And then we're going to have to choose another book to go through afterwards. It's been great.
Now, the texts are online. We've got links for you in our show notes. All you have to do is click through, find the story that you would like to read, and then the discussion will happen.
Yep, right on our new website, sherlock.toomuchscrolling.com. And yeah, that is in our show notes. You can also follow our hashtag, TMS Sherlock Holmes, to be a part of that conversation. We love hearing from you about all of that. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
We can. Mike Chen told us that we have a recovery that will happen after the pandemic. I want to thank him again for coming in to discuss his book, A Beginning at the End. I suggest that one. And there's so much great entertainment out there. I hope you're all finding something to do. If you need more information, give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-4104-TMS. Our website is toomuchscrolling.com. Our email is toomuchscrolling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Spotify and Stitcher and TuneIn Radio. And you can always ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Essenflood.
See you in the future. What I want to talk about is what I want to thank you for.